Welcome to the Week in 60 Minutes from Spectator TV. Silicon Valley has established itself as the biggest player in American politics in the wake of last week's Capitol Hill riot. So we'll explore the power that big tech yields in the age of social media. We'll speak to Professor Francois Ballou, a geneticist at University College London, who can shed light on the new strains of SARS-CoV-2 and the origins of the virus. Particularly timely this week as the WHO's investigators arrive in China. And on the rollout of vaccines, we'll turn to Israeli journalist Anshal Pfeffer to break down exactly how Israel has seemingly done so well and what it means for Benjamin Netanyahu's re-election prospects. And of course, we'll have our usual Spectator TV hit with our political editors, James Forsyth and Katie Balls, on hand to update us on the latest from Westminster. Now remember, if you subscribe to the Spectator's YouTube channel for free, you'll never miss another episode. Just click the subscribe button at the bottom right of the screen now. A very special thanks to Charles Stanley for their continued support of the Week in 60 Minutes. Charles Stanley is one of the UK's leading wealth management firms, one of the oldest companies on London Stock Exchange. We're delighted to be partners. Now, it's been just over a week since the storming of Capitol Hill by a pro-Trump mob. And what a week it's been. President Trump has been impeached for the second time. That's a first for any sitting president. While Twitter, YouTube, and Facebook have all suspended his accounts. Many of his followers then moved to Parler, an alternative social media platform. But Apple and Google quickly removed Parler from their app stores, and Amazon Web Services removed Parler from its cloud. Effectively, that deleted the platform from the internet. Silicon Valley has never quite flexed its muscles in this way before, which is why it is on this week's Spectator cover. I'm joined again by Amber Athey, the Spectator's Washington editor, and also by Peter Greenberger, former head of political advertising at Twitter and Google. Peter, let me come to you first. You once said that you were proud of Twitter's commitment to free speech. Are you still proud of it?
I am. I am proud of what the company has created over the last decade or so, creating a platform where people from all walks of life, whether you're an elected official or an everyday citizen, can have your voice heard, and to be able to read and comment on and share what other people are saying. I am also proud of what they've done just recently. I don't think this is something they took lightly. I don't think this is something they ever wanted to do. And as Jack Dorsey has said just recently, he sees this as a failure, actually, on their part, that they weren't able to maintain a healthy conversation. I disagree. I think it's a larger societal and electoral and even governmental failure. But still, I think their hand was forced.
But are you comfortable with the idea that who should be on Twitter or Facebook or others can be decided by a couple of billionaires in Silicon Valley?
I recognize, again, this is not ideal. It's not a place where we want it to be or where these companies want it to be. But I think what you have to understand is that this is not necessarily a question of the First Amendment or a question of free speech. It's a question of choice. And ultimately, these companies made the choice that they no longer wanted to assist in the dissemination or the hosting of information that they saw as, first of all, false, as misinformation, but also as dangerous, and which certainly led to, in large part, led to what happened at the U.S. Capitol on Wednesday.
So Mr. Trump has been suspended, we think, for life, because he was seen by them to be inciting violence, leading to these appalling scenes on Capitol Hill. But on Twitter, there is still a hashtag kill Trump and a hashtag assassinate Trump. And one of the tweets that goes with that hashtag is, someone take this clown, i.e. Mr. Trump, take him out now. These are all still on Twitter. Why?
If it violates their terms and conditions, they should bring it down. And I certainly haven't read or can't defend every tweet, but they have terms and conditions, which up until recently, there was this carve out under the newsworthiness label for heads of state to be able to tweet pretty much what they wanted. And I, as you mentioned, I had defended that for many years when I worked there and when I left. I think it is most times better to know what your leader is thinking than to have to guess. And in fact, we now are in that position where we hear that he is raging around an empty West Wing and we're not quite sure what's on his mind. Perhaps it would be better to know, but I will say his behavior has improved markedly now that he has lost his favorite toy.
I'm not, I mean, there is a case against what Twitter and others have done, but that's not the case I'm putting to you. It's the consistency, it's the criteria. I mean, some people will find it strange that Mr. Trump has been banned for life from Twitter, but the Ayatollah in Iran is still able to tweet his bile against Israel, talking about how the regime will perish.
I think what they've done with Trump, however, now opens the door for them to take further action, which again is not where they wanted to be. But now that they have taken this very, very dramatic, important step, I think they can look harder at the policies that they've had. Again, the terms and conditions have been that ordinary users, you and I, cannot use the platform to threaten violence or incite violence against other people. Foreign leaders, however, have been able to tweet pretty much what they want. This is what crossed the line. Should it have been, the Khomeini? Should it have been somebody else? Perhaps. But this is the time when they felt they had to make the decision. I will say that there has always been this complaint that it falls harder on certain segments. The fact is, going away from Iran back to the United States, conservatives in particular feel like they're being picked on. When you look at who's violating the terms and conditions, it's one side violating the terms and conditions at a much higher rate than the other side. Those are the accounts that have been taken
Well,
down.
hold on, let's have a look at that. Because after all, we know that Black Lives Matter use Twitter and Facebook to organize their demonstrations, many of which ended in riot and violence in Portland and Seattle. Not one of them was closed down. There's a Twitter account called Pigs in a Blanket, Fry 'em Like Bacon. Pigs in a Blanket, Fry 'em Like Bacon, referring to the police. It's a call to kill police. That Twitter account is still up as well. So
There are
ordinary
plenty
people
of.
can incite violence, and Twitter has done nothing about it.
I would disagree again. I would say on the main, it's a bit like whack-a-mole. There are millions of accounts tweeting out millions of pieces of information every day. When things are flagged and things clearly violate the terms and conditions, they make an effort to take them down. Again, there's been this accusation that it's based on partisanship. When studies have been done, they have seen that more people are making violations on the right. There is a segment of the population in the United States that believes things that are completely untrue. And it's because the leaders of the country, the elected officials of the country, and some main conservative outlets peddle in this lunacy. Even just the other day, you had a member of Congress refuse to admit who's going to be the next president or that he was elected rightfully. We had an election. It was as transparent as every other election we've ever had. And yet, for some reason, certain members of the government refuse to acknowledge it, and they're inciting this madness. So there are different levels, I think, of misinformation, and it's hard to pinpoint. We had a Justice Potter here who said, when defining something else, I'll know it when I see it. And I think finally Twitter decided they knew it when they saw it, information that they no longer wanted to host on their platform.
Can you give any examples of the Black Lives Matter organizers using social media to organize what became violent protests? Can you give any examples of them being taken down?
I don't have them handy. I'm sure they did take down organizations and people that have incited violence on the other side. The fact is, though, that they haven't incited this type of violence. It's just a mistruth. And this
Well,
comparing
Black Lives Matter have not incited any violence.
not in a not not in, in, the, in as direct a fashion as the president of the United States giving a speech to what essentially was an angry mob and directing them to the United States Capitol. People marched in the streets to provide rights for people that have not had equal rights in this country for 400 years, and that's just a different matter.
So the people who have caused the consistent violence in Seattle and in Portland are in a different category from those who caused the violence in Capitol Hill last week.
I condemn all violence, as everyone has. But yes, I would put it in a different category, actually. But either way, Twitter needs to enforce their rules equally. And I think now that they've taken this action against the president, they will take a harder look at not only other foreign other leaders, other people in power, but also other organizations who use the platform.
Was it right to ban links to the New York Post story about Hunter Biden?
That was a very difficult choice for them to make. And that's something that I think people can certainly debate freely. I think that the company themselves took a step back from that and recognized that maybe that was not the best decision that they made. But that's a hard question for them to answer. And I think that's what all these social media companies and news organizations have to answer for. What I'll say is that we have all learned a lot from 2016. There were cable networks who aired then candidate Trump's rally speeches from start to finish well before he was a front runner because it made great TV. Now, when he is speaking at the lectern in the White House press briefing room, there are cable networks that will go away from him if he starts speaking mistruths. That's mistruths. That's a remarkable change. Similarly, the social media companies would publish and post and share anything and everything related to the election under the guise of sticking to freedom of expression 4 or 5 years ago. Now they're putting some limits on that. So do you allow stories to spread that are blatantly mistrue is the first question. But of course, a very important question as you raise is who's the arbiter of truth? And these companies have said that they do not want to be the arbiter of truth. But the problem is there is no arbiter of truth. And that's what we're figuring out. Even if you're an elected official, it turns out you can say whatever helps you raise money and grift off your supporters.
In a sense, it's an issue of who guards the guardians. And I'll come back to that in a minute. But let me bring Amber in now. Surely it's only right that companies like Twitter and Facebook and others, they should not have an obligation to publish disinformation and incitement to violence.
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement. However, the problem with what they did to the president is that they actually punished him for behavior that occurred off of the platform. And Peter Tassily admitted this in one of his answers to you, Andrew. When Trump was actually removed from Twitter, they cited two specific tweets that he had sent that occurred after the Capitol riot and claimed that he was inciting further violence, but they had read that incitement into the tweet. It wasn't actually there. The first one that they had a problem with was him saying that he still believed the election was stolen. And the second one is, and I think this quote is pretty accurate, although I'm paraphrasing slightly, "For those who have been asking, I will not be attending the inauguration on January 20th. That was the second tweet from the president that they cited as incitement of violence. If you can be punished for things that you say or behavior that you engage in off of the platform, then that means the terms of service of these various social media platforms are phony.
Peter?
Well, I was going to say, if you can't take into account real life events, then I'm not sure we want anyone over there trying to arbiter or divine the interpretation of what Donald Trump's tweets are. It was very clear that he continues to perpetuate this idea that he won this election in a huge landslide and it's being stolen from him and his fellow patriots. That's ludicrous. He lost the election. Everybody knows he lost the election. I'm almost a little bit worried thinking that maybe he doesn't know. It was either he's completely delusional.
He might be the one that doesn't know.
He might be, which I don't know what's scarier. If this is A, he really believes this stuff. B, he was just playing a game to raise money and he doesn't like to lose. Or C, he really was plotting something more nefarious, right? And I think it's probably a combination of all three. But it's very clear what he's doing. And Amber, we knew where this would go. If you're part of a doomsday cult that says January 15th, the world is going to end, the sun rises on January 16th. What does everybody do who has spent the last 6, 12, 24, 48 months preparing for the end of the world? It's not coming. Biden will be inaugurated on January 20th. We've always known that. And for some reason, a sizable percentage of the American population refuses to believe that reality because they're being egged on by our leadership, frankly.
Amber?
Well, if you knew that this was going to happen, then why did these social media companies not ban the president sooner? Why is there retroactive action being taken? And I would also ask why there are multiple tweets from Democratic officials that remain up after the 2016 election, where they were questioning whether or not that election was legitimate. Nancy Pelosi has a tweet from 2017, for example, where she says that this election was not legitimate and that the president is not the true president. So why is one of those inciting violence and the other is not?
Well, I think you've just answered your question. One of them did not incite violence, and the other one did, first of all. And second of all,
tweets from the president that led to his suspension were tweets that were characterized as having the potential to incite violence after a violent event had occurred. In the same way, you could read the same thing into Pelosi's tweet. There were riots all over D.C. where people were smashing store windows and burning down the city during Trump's 2016 inauguration, and Pelosi was questioning the election in 2017. So why was hers not given the same characterization as the president's?
Because, I'll disagree, and I'll say hindsight's 2020, and there have not been mobs of people roaming the streets and certainly not breaching the sacred grounds of the U.S. Capitol, arguing that Nancy Pelosi or her party should be in charge of the White House. That it just didn't happen. And this kind of both sides-ism that we've gotten accustomed to, I think hopefully also will die a death here. But I'll also note that on October 19th, I did write a piece in the Washington Post calling for Facebook and Twitter to mute the president. I considered calling on them to mute both the president and Joe Biden, but I'm not sure anybody is reading Joe Biden's tweets as closely as they're reading the president's. They're not quite as interesting, but they're also not inciting this type of nonsense and ignorance and violence out in the country. So I would just disagree with on the face of it. I think that what people said about the presidential election in 2016, first of all, there were investigations about it. So there was at least enough of a there where people did suspect that there were some things going on that were not above level. But I'd also say that there was not violence. There hasn't been violence, certainly not to this degree.
I think what does concern people, Peter, though, is the sense of unaccountable power. Whether you agree with what Twitter has done, whether you think it's biased, that it tends to go for those on the right rather than the left, the bigger issue is unaccountable power, particularly when they seem to act in concert. I mean, these are companies far bigger than the oil, the railways, the steel, the robber barons at the end of the 19th century in America. They've got much more money and much more influence. And yet Twitter bans Trump for life, and you've given the reason why, and incitement to violence is something that there's not a right to that in free speech. But Trump's people then say, all right, we're gonna move to Parler and we can do stuff there. And then immediately the rest of big tech closes that down as well. The apps you cannot get either from Google or from Apple. And Amazon says, we ain't hosting you anymore. That's a cartel. In America, cartels are illegal.
I think that's something that the new Congress, both sides, have an interest in. And the power of big tech and whether they're using that power correctly or whether they should have that much power is something that should be looked into, and I have no doubt that it will be investigated. Ironically, though, should Section 230, for instance, which provides these platforms with the protection not to be liable for everything that people post, ironically, you remove Section 230 and Parler and Gab are gone in 30 seconds. I don't think they want to be held liable for the information that's on those platforms. And they'll learn how hard a job this is to try to monitor it. So that's a problem. And I hear your point.
When the platform said, look, we're not a newspaper. We're not. I mean, if we publish in The Spectator an incitement to violence or something that's libelous or defamatory or whatever, we are subject to the full force of the law. It can cost us a lot of money. The editor, in some circumstances, could go to jail. The social media platform said, we're not publishers. We're just a platform. We're a neutral platform. And so therefore we're not responsible for what appears. But suddenly Mr. Dorsey and Mr. Zuckerberg are saying, actually we are responsible. That's why we're taking the president down, because he's inciting violence. It's why we are closing down Parler, because it's full of insidious toxic stuff. The moment you do that, you need to be regulated and subject to the law of the land.
I'll quote Senator Mitt Romney, who at one point was looked upon favorably by the Republican Party. I'm not sure he is by everybody anymore. But he mentioned that corporations are people in a different context. Corporations are people in that they are made up of people making decisions. Want to talk about the First Amendment? The First Amendment means being able to say what you want and do business with whom you'd like to do business with. So ultimately, this was a choice. Am I comfortable that they all acted in concert? No, I'm not. But I can say that my guess is it's more about one person making a decision, everybody else looking around and saying, those guys don't seem to want to do business with people trafficking in conspiracy theories, nonsense, lies, and violence. You know what? We don't have to either. And in fact, we may end up being liable for it, depending what happens in the next Congress. So the power of the tech companies must be looked into. I think even they have called for, Zuckerberg, you mentioned, he has called for regulation. He doesn't want to be put in this position, in his own words.
Let me go back to Amber. Don't the Republicans only have themselves to blame? They have been in a position, Amber, for the past 4 years to do something about this. Maybe to take a leaf out of Teddy Roosevelt's book. He was a Republican president, admittedly rather different, more distinguished president than Mr. Trump, but he was at the forefront, along with McKinley, as well, of bringing in what became the antitrust legislation against the robber barons in America. But Amber, the Republicans did nothing about this when they had the chance to do it.
You're exactly right, Andrew. This is a major failure of the Republican Party. There were whispers about things like antitrust regulation or Section 230 reform by some members of the Republican Party, notably Senator Josh Hawley, Congressman Matt Gaetz. But outside of just a few Republicans, this was not something that was very popular. The cry from the free market conservatives was that these are private companies and therefore they get to decide who is allowed on their platforms. But when these companies start acting in coordination with one another and control so much of the internet that they can summarily ban a competitor, then that's when you start to get into an antitrust situation. And in fact, Jack Dorsey said in his statement explaining the banning of the president from multiple platforms yesterday by claiming that they had not acted in coordination with one another. However, Twitter did say from their public policy team that when they were looking at misinformation and the spread of misinformation in the Ugandan election, that they had all acted in coordination. I can't think of a better case that a company would make against its own monopolistic behavior than what Twitter admitted to just a couple of days ago.
Peter, let me finish with you. The Democrats at the moment, they now control the White House. They've got a casting vote majority in the Senate. They've got a smallish majority in the House, but they're in charge of these three key parts of government. They must think that so far, the big tech people have censored those that they think should have been censored. They're on the way on the opposite side of the aisle, sometimes way out on the far right bit of the aisle. Will they have an appetite to do anything about big tech in the next couple of years?
I think they will. I mean, certainly Senator Warren has been very vocal on this, was very vocal on this during the campaign, as well as some other more left of center Democrats in the Senate and the House. I think there are concerns to be raised. This is not something that we've seen in a while in the United States, at least since we last took antitrust action. These are very, very large, very powerful companies who have gotten to a point where they have such influence that I think that the government should take a look. And I think that that will happen, really, regardless of who's in power. I think there's appetite on both sides now. But, you know, you mentioned, Andrew, when you asked Amper, do the Republicans have themselves to blame? And in this case, I think the answer is yes. The Republicans do have themselves to blame. They have not been a responsible political party. And there's a reason why their base has become unhinged from reality. And they have a responsibility to tell the truth to their base, to stop the big lie. And hopefully that will improve the situation in society, because ultimately social media is a mirror of society. It's only going to be as good or as truthful or as valuable as the people who are posting on it.
All right, Peter, we'll leave it there. Peter and Amber, thank you so much for joining us. I know it's early where you are in the morning, and we're grateful for your time and your contributions. Thank you both.
Thank you for having me.
Now, remember, if you subscribe to The Spectator's YouTube channel, they haven't taken us off air yet, it's free and you'll never miss another episode. Just click the subscribe button at the bottom right of the screen now. On to the pandemic, it's always with us. A new strain Yes, a third one is worrying government scientists. It's from Brazil, and the government's chief scientific advisor admitted he didn't know if our vaccines could protect against it. The government has come under fire for reacting too slowly to this new outside threat, but it is difficult. These new threats seem to be emerging all the time. University College London's Professor Francois Ballou is one of the UK's leading experts in genetics. His research lies at the intersection between genomics, epidemiology, evolution, and ecology. So who better to shed light on this new strain than him? Professor, welcome to Spectator TV. What can you tell us about this new strain from Brazil?
Well, we don't know that much about it. It has some similarities with the strain we've been seeing in circulation in South Africa. In particular, it has one mutation, which is, I would say, the mutation we really worry a bit about in terms of immune escape, or let's say how well vaccines will protect against it. I'd really like to stress that it's not an immune escape strain at this stage. It might just reduce the efficacy of the vaccines a little bit.
Tell us what's happening when these strains mutate. Am I right in thinking that this is part of their survival? Is that why they mutate?
Yeah, so mutations tend to be random, and from the beginning of the pandemic, let's say initially we had very little variation in the virus population, and then diversity has been building up through mutations, and on average every strain acquires about 25 mutations a year. So most of them do absolutely nothing. They have no effect on the virus. They don't make it transmit better. They don't make it escape vaccines or immunity. But then there are a few that can change the virus a little bit. And we haven't seen much happening until very recently. But over, I would say, the last weeks, we have a few strains that seem to be a bit more different. So there is clearly evolution going on there.
And is one of the differences, Professor, is that one or two of these new strains, we think of what for a while was called the Kent virus, that it seemed to spread more quickly than the virus that we first encountered in March of this year?
Yes, there is some good evidence that this lineage, which is becoming dominant in the UK now, is more transmissible than the ones we had before. So it is not escaping immunity. It is a bit unclear how it does actually transmit better. There's still some uncertainty how much more transmissible it is. So I think we'll have to wait for a few weeks to put an exact number on it. But clearly it's gone up in frequency quite drastically over the last weeks.
And is it a rule of thumb or not that when a virus mutates, it may, as you say, it becomes more transmissible, but does it weaken when it mutates?
Not absolutely necessarily. So the only thing that matters for a virus, and actually generally evolution, is how well it replicates. So that's the only selective pressure on it. Whether it hurts us or doesn't hurt us, that's actually not so important. It's not important. It's obviously very important for us, but not for let's say, the selective pressures on the virus. Now, less symptomatic, less aggressive strains could be favored if they're not picked up, people don't feel ill, people still move around, and they pass it on to others. So that's one mechanism by which viruses can become more transmissible. But that's one of many, and it's quite difficult to make any predictions. So luckily, this strain, while it seems to transmit better, clearly doesn't create more severe symptoms, it's not more lethal, and we'll have to wait for a little bit to see what it might actually be slightly milder.
But for those of us who are not experts on this, the thing that all immediately comes into our minds when we read about some new strain of the virus is, gulp, will the vaccines that we're putting so much hope on now, that's our kind of get out of jail card, will the vaccines work against this new strain?
Yes.
What's the story there?
So all the evidence points to the vaccines working perfectly well against this strain, as well as against any other strain. So there's no reason to believe that vaccine efficacy would be lower against the Kent variant, whatever you want to call it.
Is that a general feature of viruses, Professor? That if you get a vaccine against, I mean, I suppose the biggest vaccine we've ever had in this area was against smallpox. And I'm sure smallpox must have mutated in lots of different ways. But in general, if you get a good vaccine that works, in general, it should be able to cope with a mutating virus.
Yes and no. So smallpox is a bit different. It's a very slowly evolving virus. It's a DNA virus. It's a completely different beast. Yes. I think here we what's probably more comparable is the flu, so influenza. And these are viruses that evolve quite quickly. And as we all know, let's say the flu jab needs to be redesigned on a regular basis. So essentially people, the most at risk, let's say, get vaccinated each year. And I think we have to prepare ourselves to have to update the vaccine, which is not the end of the world. So that's technically very easy to do. We have excellent surveillance in place. So we know what to expect. We know what strains are emerging. We know which ones of concern. And in principle, it won't be a major challenge to have people revaccinated on a regular basis. It might not be every year, but I would say every probably 3-4 years we'll have to, let's say, revaccinate the people who need to be vaccinated.
And are we any clearer on the week when the WHO investigators are arriving in China to investigate the origins of the virus? In the work you've done on the genomic data that you've been working on too, are we any clearer about the origins of this virus?
It jumped around October 2019 into the human population. It might have been around a little bit earlier, but let's say all the strains we've sequenced so far, that's 350,000 essentially, they all have an ancestor which dates back to around October 2019. And then it started spreading first, probably quite slowly. It reached Italy quite early. We have good evidence that it was in Italy in November 2019. It wasn't really picked up initially. And then obviously, as we all know, from late December, January on, we realized there was a problem. But by then, it was actually probably fairly widespread, at least in Europe.
Sorry, Professor, on you go.
And then obviously the question is, where did it come from? We know of related, fairly closely related viruses that circulate in bats in China. And we know actually of many of related coronaviruses in all sorts of animal populations, bats, carnivores, even birds. And these things are actually not uncommon, and it can happen that they just jump hosts. We also know that SARS-CoV-2 has a very broad host range, so it can infect humans, but it can infect primates, it can infect cats and dogs and whatever, whatnot. So I think the most likely scenario is that it was some kind of natural spillover from an animal, but then obviously and it probably happened in China, that's very, very likely, happened around October 2019. And then obviously, did it go to a lab? Let's say, was it stored in a lab? Someone got infected? This is very, very difficult to say. What I'd like to stress is that we really have no evidence that it was kind of engineered by some nefarious boffins. So it looks to me very natural. When I look at it, align the sequence against loads of other coronaviruses, I can see nothing really super special about it.
So one of the extreme conspiracy theories that we don't need to dwell on is that China essentially intentionally unleashed this virus. Let's park that. The official story for a while was it came from the wet markets, almost naturally. But would it also be possible that the lab in Wuhan was working, experimenting with this virus, doing perfectly legitimate scientific research into it, and it got out somehow? It just kind of, it lost it.
Yeah, I think we cannot rule this out at this stage, and I hope there will be a proper investigation to clarify that. But even if it happened, to be absolutely brutally honest, similar things have happened before. And there's always a small risk that, let's say, something can escape from a lab. If I hope it won't happen, and I hope we will be more careful in the future, but these things have happened in the past.
There was some data I'd just like you to mark our card on this from Italy. It got some people quite excited in China, because it said the blood samples taken in September had tested positive for COVID-19 antibodies, and the Chinese started to say, ah, so it shows that virus, it didn't originate with us if it was September. But what, I mean, for those of us who are anything but experts in this area, we just don't know what to make of that. What do you make of it?
Yeah, there have been several similar claims in the literature, including in peer-reviewed journals. I have to say that these studies were not particularly carefully performed. There's always a risk of false positive with this kind of test. And if you just screen samples, especially old samples that have not been necessarily conserved in perfect conditions, you can pick up some false positives. And I wouldn't say the evidence is convincing at all. The really convincing evidence we have is for cases in December and November in France and northern Italy. So actual cases, there's one from early November, child, and it's pretty convincing that this was an actual case. And then we have some evidence from wastewater, also from northern Italy, which suggests that it was in circulation in December.
Interesting. Professor, I think in this, what I might call the second wave, the number of cases, the huge rise and the number of deaths, has taken a lot of people by surprise, certainly a lot of non-experts by surprise, from the government down. And January and February look like being pretty dark days in Britain and in other countries too. Our hope, our optimism, if there is any, is all around the vaccine as it's rolled out. And we in Britain seem to be doing pretty well compared to other countries in rolling out that vaccine. And there's talk now that it could well be about 19 million people getting it by the end of February, sometime into early March. Are we right to have that as to regard that as the light at the end of the tunnel, and the light is not an oncoming train?
I absolutely agree. So the vaccine will be absolutely essential to bring us back to normal. But let's say the vaccine is a brilliant, beautiful tool that will help us getting back meaningful normal life a bit sooner. But fundamentally, pandemics come to an end. Now, there's an element of seasonality. So I would say many people predicted actually this winter wave, predicted this winter wave to be more severe than the spring wave. So that's really in line with what we know from enveloped RNA viruses, which have this highly seasonal behavior. They transmit best in dry, cold air. And obviously, by transmitting the infect people, and people gain immunity, now obviously at a terrible cost, and by having also a large fraction, as large as possible, of the population being protected by the vaccine rather than infection, we obviously decrease the burden quite dramatically. But that's really the burden in terms of morbidity and mortality. But fundamentally, the pandemic would come to an end. There's no doubt about that. We have experienced previous pandemics, let's say influenza pandemics in 1918, 57, 68, the mild one in 2009. But let's say it feels like the end of the world, but let's say there's definitely light at the end of the tunnel. And obviously the vaccine news is wonderful, and it will accelerate, let's say, the ending of the pandemic.
Well, we'll keep our eye on that light, even if it still seems a little far away at the moment. Professor, thank you for the work you're doing in this area, and for your expertise, and for sharing that with us on Spectator TV today. Thank you.
Thank you to you. Bye.
That's so, Professor Ballou there. Let's go now to politics. I bring in our political team, James Forsyth, our political editor at The Spectator. Katie Ball is the deputy political editor. James, I come to you first on the politics of it. It's, as I was saying to the professor there, big number of cases, maybe flattening out now. Big number of deaths as well. Another row over school meals. But the vaccine rollout going pretty well, James. Where are we? What's the politics of this?
I think that everything hinges on the vaccine rollout, the speed with which that can happen. I think if you get to a situation where the government can hit its target for vaccinating 13.5 million people, the most vulnerable by the middle of February, and it's then vaccinating at a rate of 2 million people a week, that would suggest that you could really massively significantly loosen up restrictions sometime in April. Looking at the UK rollout compared to other countries in Europe, you know, the UK then should be able to come out of restrictions earlier. If that happens, I think that would give people a much more positive sense of the government's handling of the pandemic than they have today. And I think people would, you know, because right now the numbers in terms of the economic hit, the death numbers, these are not good for the government. And so the government needs a success story on the vaccine if it is to come out of this pandemic in political shape.
The scale of this second wave, though, seems to have shut up, or should I put it another way, muted the lockdown skeptics on the Tory side, though.
Yeah, I think you look at the current numbers and the debates about when ICU capacity might be overrun, and it's very hard to say that you should adopt an approach of allowing people to take their own judgments about how much risk. I also think that the shift in the Swedish approach, you know, that has underlined essentially the one alternative model for handling this pandemic.
Indeed. Katie, free school meals, back in the headlines again. What is it about this government and free school meals?
Yes, it's a hill where many say, is this the hill the government would choose to die on? Because they often find themselves in a situation where they not even perhaps even defend their policy, but they sit there a bit awkwardly and then eventually forced into changing it. And it annoys a lot of the MPs in the process. I think what we saw this week relates to hampers. I don't think that these fit what anyone would imagine as a definition of a hamper, but the actual food packages going to those who are on free school meals, subpar, below the required, the suggested outline of what is in them. And I think when photos first surfaced on social media with Marcus Rashford, the footballer, once again leading the charge, initially a little bit of scepticism actually from some on the Tory side, suggesting this was, you know, point scoring causing trouble. But this time I think a much quicker response from the centre in terms of number 10 in quite quickly saying, oh, we don't recognise this, we think this is very bad too. And then a strange sight on Wednesday at Prime Minister's Questions when Boris Johnson actually praised Marcus Rashford for providing the real opposition, suggesting that Keir Starmer wasn't as effective as Marcus Rashford at holding the government to account, pointing out when they had problems. So it's trying to spin it a bit. I think in terms of where we are now, you have a situation where the government is obviously trying to blame the companies on this, but now people are looking at the government recommended amounts and saying it's not actually that different to what's in some of these pictures people are getting very angry about.
But the government had, when it was last faced with this need to provide, with schools closed, to provide lunches for those who qualified for free school lunches, it had a voucher system. It didn't get involved in creating packages of food. It sent out vouchers which the parents could then use to substitute for free school meals. Why did it not have that on the shelf ready to run again?
Well, I think that's what a lot of people are asking. And you saw when ministers are trying to calm down this row, they said, look, the voucher system is nearly coming into effect. Just wait for the vouchers. And they're saying actually part of this is down to choice. But I think there's clearly been an issue in rolling that out at the right speed and making sure that option is clearly available to everyone. And therefore, I think even though the government is trying to say this row has nothing to do with us, I don't think that is really washing with quite a lot of people.
James, is that there's been talk, if this Brazilian strain that I was discussing with the professor from UCL there, if it turns out to be even more virulent in terms of transmission than the what we call the Kent strain, that there may have to be an even tougher lockdown. Yet on the other hand, I see the number of cases are beginning to flatten out the London hospital situation beginning to ease up a bit. Where do you think we'll go with this? Stick with what we have, or possibility of even stricter lockdown rules?
So I think it's quite hard to tighten up the current lockdown rules without getting back into making very difficult decisions, saying to people who live on their own, for example, you just shouldn't expect to see anybody until for another month or so. I think that's quite a hard thing to ask people to do. And I think one of the questions, it's one of the political weaknesses for the government here is, but you know, there's been another announcement of another delay in testing requirements before people enter the country. And I think people are saying, well, hang on a second, there are all of these strains out there that are causing concern. Why is there not a stricter testing and quarantining regime at the UK's airports? If you look at those Asian democracies that has handled this crisis so much better than the UK has, think of South Korea, they've got far, far stricter policies around testing on arrival and quarantining. And I think there is puzzlement about why wait? You know, why are we waiting for a cabinet committee meeting today to move forward on banning travel from flights coming in from Brazil? Why is this testing regime at the airports not set up yet? And so I think that is going to be an issue for the government, which is, you know, why has the borders, you know, that's one of the lessons from March, which clearly is that the UK kept its borders open for too long, didn't have testing requirements for people coming in. You know, I think there'll be a real danger for the government if that is repeated and you end up with a new, more virulent, more transmissible strain being imported into the country and restrictions having to be tightened up again.
I mean, I think most people would probably think that if you're coming into the country from wherever, you may be coming from a place where the epidemic is so high that travel, but there should be no air corridor from that place. But in general, if you're coming in from Europe or North America or the Far East, either you should have a test certificate that shows you were negative, taken in the last, 48, 72 hours, or you have to be tested immediately on landing. But that's not the situation, James, is it?
No, not yet. And I mean, they've announced another delay to that coming in. And I think people are puzzled as to why it has taken so long to get this kind of airport testing regime up and running. And it's particularly puzzling given that the UK testing capacity is so much greater now than it was at the beginning of this pandemic.
So we would have the testing capacity to, I saw somewhere that we have the ability, we have the capacity to do 700,000 tests a day. Now, given the number of people flying in, that would be, and of course it's not all going to go just on that, but clearly we have the capacity to do this now, I would have thought.
Yeah, and if you talk to people who've travelled during this pandemic, you know, we are one of the laxer countries in terms of the rules, in terms of how much where you can quarantine, whether you need a test on arrival, and there is clearly a case for tightening that up, especially because I think one of the things that, as you were saying about what's changed the lockdown skeptics' minds, I think one of the other things that has changed Tory MPs' minds on this, who are more pragmatic, is one of the biggest threats to the vaccine rollout programme right now is the disease getting out of control again. If you look at the regional breakdown of stats, Andrew, that's just been released on where people have been vaccinated, London is doing very badly. And one of the explanations for that is that because the virus is so prevalent, or has been so prevalent in London, but that has made it harder to kind of ramp up the vaccination programme. And given the kind of economic and human cost of staying locked down, you know, clearly you should be doing everything you can to try and get things back to normal as quickly as possible. And one key part of that is controlling the virus enough so that you can vaccinate at pace.
Katie, finally, looking at the vaccine rollout, I mean, there's a bit of arguments about who should be the next priorities and so on. And there's GPs saying they need more. There's always some wrinkles. But overall, am I right in thinking that so far, so good?
Yes, I think as a broad kind of judgment of where we are, I think that is where ministers feel as though they are. And yes, we are having complaints about some of the bureaucracy still in place. If you look at pharmacies and getting out the vaccine, the spread across the country, why some places cannot get more vaccines just because they've been perhaps effective at getting it out. But ultimately, yes, publicly, you keep hearing ministers say, you know, not only have we done XX many vaccines, that is more than all these European countries put together, very keen to land there. But secondly, I get the impression they're even more optimistic privately than they are publicly, because there has been a switch recently where this government has had a reputation for over-promising and under-delivering, and they are consciously trying to do the opposite, under-promise, over-deliver. Now, the jury's out on that, but I do think that actually when it comes to that target and the pace, I think there's a lot of optimism that they might actually go quite a bit quicker.
Well, it would be nice if they underpromised and overperformed or overdelivered for a change. That would be good. We'll keep an eye on it as the vaccine continues to be rolled out across the United Kingdom. James and Katie, thanks for joining us on Spectator TV. And we finish with vaccines, though, because one country's name has come up again and again as a world leader in this vaccination rollout against the pandemic, and that country is Israel. It's managed to vaccinate a fifth of its population already. Now, it's a small population compared to Britain, but a fifth is still a lot. Israeli journalist Anshul Pfeffer writes in The Spectator this week that, as elsewhere, the program in Israel has become political because, of course, Prime Minister Netanyahu is heading yet again for election in March. Anshul, welcome to Spectator TV. Let's start with the vaccination program. Tell us what's been happening in Israel and why Israel seems to be doing really pretty well in this regard.
Well, the rollout began almost 4 weeks ago. And since the rollout has been organized by the four Israeli public health funds, which are in a competition with each other, and they have a very, very strong connections with their members, that The amount of vaccinations that they've been able to carry out in this time is quite high. They've opened hundreds of vaccination centers across the countries in their clinics, in hospitals, even in especially set up compounds for vaccinations. And it's been working seamlessly almost for 4 weeks now. And there's a very high public awareness, and each of these four funds, and you know, you have to imagine that you've got something like the NHS, but four times over, and four NHSs competing with each other to roll out the vaccine as fast as possible for its members, and that's a major element of why it's been happening.
No, like I said, I want to come back to that structure because it is interesting to have kind of four NHSs competing. But let me, as opposed to our monopoly of in the NHS. But let me come back to some of the detail. First of all, what vaccine are they using?
They'll be using the Pfizer-BioNTech. There has been a shipment of Moderna vaccines as well, but right now they're focusing on the Pfizer one.
And is the policy there? And all these questions, as you'll understand, are relevant to what's happening in the rest of Europe and the United Kingdom. Are they concentrating, as seems to be the case now in Britain, of getting people, get them a first vaccine and worry about a second vaccine later?
No, every Israeli who goes in to get the first jab goes out with a printout of an appointment 3 weeks hence, and quite a large number have already got the second jab. There was a discussion here in Israel over the last few weeks whether to go down the same path as Britain and first of all try and jab as many people as possible with the first jab. They decided that since the cooperation with Pfizer is working well and Pfizer is shipping a sufficient number of doses to Israel over the time, and the logistics chain is working well, there's no reason not to adhere to the protocol of having the second jab after 3 weeks.
Are we seeing some of Israel's huge assets coming into play here? It is the Silicon Valley of your part of the world, indeed of the hemisphere. It's a huge advanced IT and in biotech. It's got an incredibly efficient military. It's got a wonderful industry. Has this all come into play to help in the vaccine effort?
Well, Andrew, you mentioned two assets. You mentioned the high-tech community and you mentioned the military.
Yes.
When it comes to high-tech, now in the vaccine effort, that certainly has been a major element because, you know, we mentioned the four health funds. Each of these health funds are very much invested in outreach, in digital outreach to patients. So patients have their medical records, their doctor records going back 20 years, all at, you know, within, you know, they can just touch a keyboard and they can get it. It's all on, they all have customized apps on their smartphones from whatever health fund they're working for. So they have this very high level of engagement with their GPs, with their clinics, and they can be called in very easily, very quickly for vaccines. And there are even cases where people have received an appointment for in a week or two, and suddenly they'll get a phone call. Actually, we have a load of doses right now in the clinic, and we want to make sure that we use all of them. Can you come in earlier? Can you come in another half an hour? Can you come in this evening? Many people have been vaccinated in that way, because that is really very much to do with the technology, because the level of contact is so high. And the technology gives something else. It gives Pfizer a chance to observe an entire population being vaccinated almost in real time, because so much of the data is available to the Israeli health authorities. And part of the deal with Pfizer, under which Pfizer has agreed to give Israel early shipments of the vaccine, includes also access to this data. There are concerns about patient privacy here as well. But for Pfizer, this is a very good opportunity to see how well their vaccine is working, not just in the trials that they've carried out until now, but in an actual 9 million sized population with different kinds of groups, different ages, different health conditions, and so on. So technology has been a big part. The military, which was involved in different parts of the pandemic before that, in trying to set up the contact tracing, for example, that has been less successful. They're involved in a small way in the vaccination drive. They're providing transport. They're providing, in some places, medics, but that's a small part. It's really mainly been done by the civilian public health funds.
Interesting, because the military here, I think, has had to play a bigger role, but your health system perhaps doesn't need the military in the way that Britain has needed to supplement its health.
Well, a country, there's only one logistical storage center near the airport when the doses are flown in from Belgium, where they're manufactured, right. And it's a matter of hours to ship them to any part
for
of the
country. The whole country. Yeah. I understand. Tell us a bit about this, the four publicly funded health systems and how that operates. In general, the principle is still like the NHS, that health is free at the point of delivery.
There's a very tiny, almost symbolic fee that you pay for a doctor's visit. It's usually about equivalent of £2 or £3. So that's not a major issue, but by and large, it's almost free at the point of delivery. But instead of having one service, for political or for historic reasons, because the health funds were originally set up by political parties or by workers' unions, four of them still exist, and they basically divide the entire population between them. Now, as an Israeli citizen, you have the right to choose your fund, and you can move at any time. Most people don't want to move because you've got your GP, you've got you know your clinic and so on, but you have the ability to move, and that keeps this kind of tension of competition between the four funds. And like I said, this kind of created an ecosystem where delivering vaccines very quickly was relatively simple.
And I mentioned that it looks like Israel has done about a fifth of its population. I think the population of Israel is just a little bit over 9 million. Do you have any idea then when the whole population will be vaccinated?
Well, obviously they're not vaccinating children now, but they want to reach a sort of two thirds of the grown-up population by the end of March, and that is very conveniently also when Israel's holding its next election.
Indeed, and I want that's going to be my final question, but before I do, the Arab population in Israel, Palestinian population and so on, that I assume is all part of this vaccination rollout.
Israel's Arab citizens living within what's called the Green Line or the pre-1967 borders are Israeli citizens. They've received vaccination like everyone else. Also the 300,000 Palestinians living in East Jerusalem, which is under Israeli control. They're not citizens, but they have full access to Israeli health care, so they also are vaccinated. The 5 million Palestinians living in the West Bank and Gaza under different, it's arguable what the level of military occupation there is, are under the responsibility of the Palestinian Authority. And there is a legal argument of what Israel's responsibility is. Behind the scenes, Israel is working with the Palestinian Authority to help them get vaccinated as well. But because of lots of political reasons, nobody wants to say out publicly that Israel is taking care of them. It's not good for Netanyahu's politics.
Interesting. And finally, then, the election. Yet another one. I've lost count.
Number four.
And also the results are so complicated as well when you get them. It takes ages. So there's another one on March the 23rd. Mr. Netanyahu, who's had his troubles and hasn't been a clear victor in recent elections. I assume this vaccination program must be a help to the incumbent prime minister.
Well, since we're in a pandemic, there are no political rallies. But the Prime Minister can and does take television crews with him every day to another vaccination centre. Sometimes he goes to the airport to greet a big crate of doses coming from Belgium. It's basically his entire campaign. He even changed the banner on his Twitter account the other day from a photo of him together with Donald Trump, which is not so, it's a bit toxic now, so a photo of him being jabbed by his own personal doctor. That is Netanyahu's campaign. I am the one bringing Israel out of the pandemic. I am delivering Israel. Thanks to my incredible connections overseas, I've brought all these doses on time. You know, he almost says it as if he paid for them himself, though. Obviously, it's taxpayer money. And Netanyahu's re-election campaign is vote for me. I'm the national vaccinator.
Tell me this just final thing, because we saw a different approach to peacemaking in the Middle East under Mr. Trump. And he, whether it was him himself or the administration, it brought together the Sunni Arab Gulf states and in Israel as well. It did not include the Palestinians in the peace process. And there was a general fear that the common enemy was Iran for the Sunni Arabs and for Israel itself. It was very much a product of the Trump years. Is there a fear? And so far, it's Bahrain, I think, has recognized you. The UAE.
Exactly.
And there could be more coming as well.
Morocco, Sudan, yeah. Four Arab states.
Exactly. So is there a worry in Israel that the Biden administration might not continue down this road?
There is a concern, certainly within the Netanyahu government, because there are a number of parameters that changed under Trump. First of all, Barack Obama tried to sort of balance America between the Sunni states and Shia Iran, while Trump firmly put his focus on alliances with the Sunnis and with Israel at Iran's expense. So this, like you said, there was this creation of the joint enemy. And there's also the Palestinian issue. Since the Trump administration didn't really care for the Palestinians, the whole diplomatic orthodoxy that existed for decades, that first of all, Israel needs to achieve a breakthrough with the Palestinians, and only then Israel will have peace with the wider Arab world, that paradigm has changed. We've seen our Arab states making peace with Israel without waiting for any progress on the Palestinian front. Now, that may change under the Biden administration if they change America's diplomatic priorities in the Middle East.
Well, we shall see. It'll be a fascinating a story as it develops. Anshul, thanks for joining us on Spectator TV.
Thank you.
For the article you wrote for The Spectator this week, which is excellent. I recommend everybody have a look at it, for giving us your time today. Thank you. Bye-bye. Now, that's it for this week. Thanks to our other guests as well, of course. And a very special thanks to our sponsor, Charles Stanley. Continuing to sponsor the week in 60 Minutes. Charles Stanley is one of the UK's leading wealth management firms, one of the oldest firms on the London Stock Exchange. We are at The Spectator delighted to have Charles Stanley as our partners in this television venture. Now, final reminder that if you subscribe to The Spectator's YouTube channel, and you should, it's free, you'll never miss another episode, because you just click the subscribe button at the bottom right of the screen now, and you'll get warnings as to when the next edition of Spectator TV is coming up. As always, send us any thoughts you may have to Spectator TV @spectator.co.uk. We read them all. Join us again next week. Thanks for watching.